Yeah, my name's Nick, and this is basically my first time telling my story. I told it one other time at Club 101, kind of off the cuff, but I mean, like on Zoom and in front of a bunch of you guys. So I left Austin Recovery after a 30-day stay, March 22nd of last year. So that gives me almost 15 months of sobriety today. So not any long time or anything like that. Not sure if you guys remember March of 2020, but there was quite a panic going around over a certain pandemic. And I had to laugh, like, after years of being really good at isolating, while being a drug addict. I was not ready to, like, live my life. And we were told that there was a lockdown in place, so some irony there. Anyways, let's start from the beginning. I was born on February 15th, 1984, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I was the first of two boys. My brother born about 4 years after me. My parents divorced when I was around 5 years old, I think. And I don't really have much memory of them being together, and I really have no memory whatsoever of them getting along, especially in the early years of the divorce. My mom had a lot of resentment, justified resentment, towards my dad. There was a lot of friction there. When they split up, my mom moved us to a suburb of Milwaukee called Wauwatosa, and her and my grandfather, her father, bought a duplex, and so my grandfather lived upstairs, and which was really, really nice for me, especially looking back on it. When my mom, being a single mom now, she was working a full-time job at an architecture firm. She's a proposal writer, and was going to school full time. So instead of having to be dragged to a daycare or babysitter, my grandpa got to watch us whenever, we weren't in school. So, that's really lucky. There's a lot of things, like, you take for granted growing up, or you don't even think about. And as you get older, you realize how incredibly fortunate you are for certain things that seem so simple. So basically, my mom raised us. We saw our dad every other weekend, and like Tuesdays and Thursdays for a few hours after school. So that was kind of my living arrangement growing up. And it was very different. My mom is very liberal in her beliefs, free to, choose what you believe in, and after my mom and dad got divorced, I believe my dad needed something kind of to cling on to, and found, like, hardcore evangelical, Southern Baptist style religion. Women wear skirts down to their ankles, like, you no listening to rock music, shit like that, and that was a big shock. Even as a young child, my dad, my dad played in bands. Music was a big part of my life. And all of a sudden, there was, like, a complete 180, as far as how my dad was living his life. He actually was an alcoholic too, but ended up, when this whole thing happened, stopped drinking. And so, like, I'm not going to say traumatic, because that seems a little overdramatic, but, like, as big of a culture shock as that was, having to, like, spend time with him when he had changed his whole persona, some good things did come out of it. He did stop drinking, and he, kind of, cleaned up his act, I guess you could say. But it was quite a show. It was different. My mom did agree with it. Like, she didn't like us going over there. We would, my brother and I both would, cry when we'd have to go to our dad's early on when we were younger. But overall, I had a really good childhood. I grew up in a nice neighborhood. I had great friends, good school system. excuse me. I getting over a sinus infection. So, you know, my mom was and is just the most important person in my life. I mean, I would be a completely different person without her. Well, I mean, I wouldn't be alive without her, but you know, like without her influence in my life, you know, Italian family, food was a big part of our lives growing up. My brother and I grew up cooking with my mom. My brother's still a chef to this day. And, you know, big appreciation for that. Sports were also really big for me growing up. I was, you know, big into playing sports, watching sports, you know, collecting baseball cards, along with, you know, my close friends. And, you know, we were a very big, like, you know, Green Bay Packers, Brewers, Bucks family. And I still kind of carry that to this day. But like I said, the biggest thing was music. Music was huge. For both my mom and dad. My dad was definitely into good music. My grandpa played guitar. He played guitar. And eventually, like, you know, I played guitar as well. So one of the, like, early memories I have of that was listening to, you know, old albums and tapes that my dad had, things like that. And, you know, music, hearing a good song or hearing something I liked, good music made me cry. Like it was an emotional thing for happy, sad, whatever. Like I always felt something, you know, powerful in music. And I loved that feeling, you know, even before I knew like other people felt that way or that was, you know, a common emotion, is to feel that way about music. Anyway, school was school, and I wasn't bad. I wasn't too much into it. Like elementary school was whatever. Middle school was awkward. High school was socially fun, but I was an underachiever. You know, I graduated with like, I think a 2.9. And, my first, you know, drug experience was, I think, like eighth grade or freshman year when I started smoking pot, you know, and we would like steal beers here and there, but weed was kind of like the first thing. And also Vicodin. My mom had, you know, some issues with, or some, you know, surgeries when growing up, but she would hate taking any sort of pain medication. She just made her sick. So we had Vicodin in the cabinet, and I don't know how or why I ended up taking one or how I knew that those were the pills that felt good, but I did, you know, and I didn't know at the time, like what an opiate was obviously or anything like that, but I liked the way they felt. And, I guess by sophomore year in high school, sophomore junior year, I was taking, you know, hallucinogens, acid, mushrooms, stuff like that. Nothing hard. You know, I did well in school, well enough, you know, obviously graduated. Like I had really good friends that my mom liked, and they were around all the time. It was around my freshman year. It was my freshman year when my grandfather moved from the upstairs apartment to an assisted living, home. And so I was given my own apartment. You know, my brother and I shared a room up till then. And so, you know, to have like the whole upstairs as my own going into high school, like, you know, popular place to be. So my friends congregated there. We would, you know, drink up there and smoke and like, you know, thought we were getting away with it. But like years later, mom was like, yeah, I knew what you guys were doing, but I knew your friends, you guys were, you know, safe there, you know? And so, but she was like, you're not sly. You're not getting away with anything, whatever. So, but yeah, so like I was kind of, you know, I was popular kid in high school. It was fine. It was good. You know, I had good experience growing up. And so after high school, I really didn't, you know what I wanted to do. I wasn't going to go to college, at least not right away. It wasn't something I didn't want to do. It was kind of like, I'm interested in so many things. I don't know what to, you know, focus on. And like, it seemed like such an overwhelming thing, to go to school. Anyway, I worked, you know, random jobs just to save money and travel. I followed a band around for a lot of my, you know, late teens, early 20s and beyond. And so I was kind of, you know, I was definitely enjoying life, but there was still something more that I wanted. And I just never took those first steps or put the work in to make that happen. You know, and so I, you know, like that, whether that was just like following my dreams or practical things like going to school and finding a career, which I'm still, you know, focusing on now. So like 2009, I just needed a change and moved to Denver. At this point, like I, you know, I was completely on my own. Obviously I've been living on my own for a while now, but you know, I was far away from home, you know, and I was starting a whole new life. And I was, by this point in my life, I'd been, you know, I'd done cocaine a little, you know, like socially, I guess, but, it wasn't, you know, anything crazy, nothing like that. But, about a year into living there, a buddy of mine from high school moved out who had started this business that's around the country. And, it's a very big party business. It was like a, called the Pedal Tavern. I think they even have one in Austin. It's like this pedal powered vehicle that people rent out to drive around town, go to bars and bar crawl and, party on. And so we started the one in Denver and it blew up. And so pretty much like overnight we were, you know, being interviewed on the news and like meeting with the mayor and stuff for all this like logistical stuff. We were just kind of thrust as like these little, you know, local like faces to be known in Denver type of thing, running this party business. And I never was like a huge drinker. It didn't appeal to me that like sloppy manner or whatever. But, up to this point, like for the past couple of years, I knew some people who had like OxyContin that was around and like, I liked the way that made me feel, but I still didn't like put together that like, it was like an opiate. I didn't think of that. It wasn't like an everyday thing. However, once I got to Denver, you know, there was the, you know, you meet people and you get free things when you're working in a business like that at bars where you're getting comped, and all of a sudden we're making really good money, you know, and, you know, I'm not working like a conventional job, so I can kind of do whatever I want, you know? And, I started doing Roxycodone, like the 30 milligram Roxycodones that, replaced OxyContin when they took that off the market. And it started with, you know, like maybe taking a half and being like cool with it, you know, and then like, well, I think one, two, you know, it escalated like anything else. And so, it was one of those things where it was like, I could tell we were, you know, I didn't at all acknowledge that I had like a drug problem, but it was kind of like, it was almost like a solution. Like I have to be working this party style business and I don't want to drink. So I have this that'll keep me like in the mood to be with all these, you know, drunk ass idiots that are throwing cash at us. So like, cool, I'll do this all day, every day, all weekend, whatever, you know? You know, I mean, I used to like, you hear like, I used to have a drug problem. Now I can afford it. And so I was just more and more every day putting, you know, taking tons of Roxycodone. And, eventually I was waiting in a parking lot for my dealer and another guy pulled up and, you know, he was like, oh, what are you waiting for? Like he knew we were, me and my buddy were waiting for some drug. And, you know, I remember specifically saying like, oh, Coke, thinking that's socially acceptable to say. He's like, cool. And it turned into me being like, no, I'm waiting for, you know, thinking maybe he had some of this too, another new connection waiting for Roxy's 30s. And he's like, well, why don't you just buy heroin? Like, it's cheaper, it's better, you know? And I was like, you know, no, that's a bad word. You know, I'm not doing that. And seriously, like we parted ways. He gave me his number in case I would change my mind. Within 45 minutes, we changed our minds. You know, my buddy Nick and I is the one, you know, started this business. And, yeah, after that, I was like, well, shit, this is way better. Like it's way, You get way more of your money. This is just, what was I thinking? You know, why was I wasting? It was more like a financial decision by then. I just felt like I was doing like a responsible thing, you know, like why dig around with this and I can do this. So this went on for a while, like, quite a while, but like in Denver, before things got really bad, I guess like 2013, I was also working at like a, just for, this guy, it was like a high-end car dealership, basically, and he just ran it for a tax write-off to take a loss, you know, because his family was incredibly wealthy and he was biding his time, you know, whatever. And I remember driving in one of the company cars, I think it was a Bentley or something like that, a nice car that, you know, I was pulled over in because of some expired plate. So it had nothing to do with me. It was the dealer and I went to jail, you know, and then I remember getting out of jail and, you know, immediately getting high because, you know, withdrawing in jail sucks. So the next day I was driving along, you know, I-25 during rush hour and like knotted off the wheel and flipped my car like 6 times, you know, just smashed it to hell. Like wasn't wearing my seatbelt, ended up, you know, coming to sitting where the passenger window should have been. And my first thought was like, shit, you know, I better find my drugs and finish them before the cops get here. Apparently like they'd already been to the car, and like, I'll never forget. It's still really odd to me. So like I pushed my way out of this car and I crawl out, you know, and then a cop runs up and there's already like traffic blocked for miles, police squad cars, ambulances everywhere. And cop, you know, I'm standing on the side of the road by then. No one sees me get out. And like, he's like, you know, hey, we said no more, you know, bystanders, no more people watching, blah, 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 stand back. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. Like I was driving, I just got out of the car. And he was like, so matter of fact about it. It still shocks me to this day how like blunt he was. Just like, we just figured anyone in there was dead, you know? And like, didn't, it was just so odd. Like they didn't bother to try and get someone out. Cause I mean, it was on a side, I don't know, but that always haunted me. Like I had nightmares of that, not the actual crash or anything like that, but just how he told me that, you know? And so, you know, things were starting to get, as what I now call unmanageable, you know? And you think I'd learned my lesson? Absolutely not. Like no way. I didn't get in any trouble for that legally. You know, they wanted to take me in an ambulance, said, no way, you know, I don't have insurance anyway or whatever. And so, long story short, by like 2014, things were getting, you know, pretty out of hand. And like people were reaching out to my mom that knew me in Colorado and saying like, we don't know what it is with Nick, but he's definitely got a problem, you know? Cause I mean, I definitely kept the fact that like, I was a junkie, like as this kind of a secret here. So, I moved home in 2014 and that was like right when my mom had the, house up for sale. And she was moving to Austin. My brother had moved here like 10 years prior. And so I was like sober, I guess you could say, for a couple months, which just meant I wasn't doing heroin. I was on methadone and taking Adderall and smoking and even drinking a lot, which is so out of character for me. You know, I got a job through a family member at an accounting firm and like I was, you know, trying to be as responsible as I could, but eventually like I knew too many people back home in Milwaukee that, you know, did dope too. And like I slipped back into it. You know, I was like still functioning and going to work sometimes, I guess. Like I was like kind of just saving face. So it was around 2016. You know, after a couple months of just treading water, I guess, I met a girl who I started dating and was trying to like hide my addiction, but you know, that doesn't, I mean, I couldn't, you know, when you're around someone like that, she figured it out very quickly. And she, you know, I introduced her. She's a good girl, like had a really good job. You know, was like a CrossFit and power lifter, had her shit together. And I introduced her to heroin and, you know, she'd never done anything like that before. And you know, at first it was definitely overwhelming, you know, like, but she liked it. And, I knew that was wrong. You know, I didn't feel good about that. But at the same time, when you're deep in an addiction, you feel good having someone like to do it with, you know, like to kind of live that life with you, I guess you could say, or make it seem like your life isn't as fucked up as it is because you're with someone who is, I don't know, it's hard to explain it. I'm sure you guys kind of know what I'm talking about. So like, and obviously like it didn't, you know, my life was already pretty fucked, but like she was still, you know, being able to work and do all the shit. Like, you know, we started obviously spending a lot of money and she made good money. So it was kind of like, you know, definitely a lot of codependency there too. But, you know, it's you can't escape from it. You know, she eventually, I was dragging her down with me, you know, and things were getting more and more out of hand. We had, you know, she was working, but we were spending all of our money basically, you know, between both of us, you know, just getting high all the time. And like, one thing I can say is that like, we never turned on each other. There was never a moment where I scored that I wouldn't share with her 50-50 and likewise, but it was around like 2019, late 2019. We're going to skip to here, I guess. Like, she got eventually like fentanyl, you know, started hitting the scene and there was a time where she was driving and both of us don't remember. We just like blacked, ended up in a snowbank, you know, like, and she got a, you know, an OWI and like a few months later got another one. And eventually, you know, her job that she'd been working there, you know, for the past 3-4 years, whatever, 3 years, I guess, I'm, you know, on drugs was figuring it out. Like we were getting, you know, more and more fucked off. So that's when, basically like she was, you know, her boss approached her and kind of like said, listen, like she was nodding off at her desk, shit like that, you know? And I think they knew something was wrong for a while, tried to bait her just to ask for help. But they were like, we need you to take a drug test. And she said, hey, I'm going to fail this. And they gave her like a leave and said, we're going to, you know, send you to 3 months of treatment, you know? And she was like, she was going to take it, you know? And that's kind of where I, you know, she told me basically like, hey, listen, I'm going to do this. And like, I can't take you with me here. So like, it sucks that it has to end this way, but like, I just want you to know if you stay in this house, you will die here, you know? And like, I'll never forget that, hearing that, you know, it still kind of haunts me because like, it was true. And I had already felt for a while, you know, the past couple of years, especially before that, I knew I needed help. Like, we tried to quit. Like I've tried to get, you know, Suboxone off the street and quit by myself and it never lasted. I couldn't do it. You know, I couldn't even get past like the physical symptoms, let alone the mental obsession, you know? So that was kind of when like, I had to do something, you know, and honestly, like when she said that, I was kind of like, yeah, all right. You know, you're right. I will die here if I stay here. So that's what I'm going to do. You know, like, I was like, I just want it to happen. I never would take my own life. I don't even have the guts to do that, honestly. And I wouldn't want to do that to people in my life, but I was definitely kind of okay with the fact that it would probably happen. But, you know, as time went on and up to that point, I was kind of like, shit, it's not. I'm just going to live an increasingly miserable life and dig myself a bigger hole. And then eventually, like, I'm going to have to survive this and move on. And it's going to be shittier because I'm going to have a deeper hole to get out of. So a few days, this is like 2020, let's say, it was late January this all happened, so it was like February. And I called my mom, and I called my mom on February 13th of 2020. And I told her, listen, like, I have a problem. And I'll never forget this either. She's like, yeah, you have a lot. What's up? You know, like, just thinking, like, you know, it's you, you know. And so I'm like, no, this is like a big one, you know. So sit your ass down. Like, this is going to get real, you know. And I told her, and she was like, okay, we'll figure this out, you know, and we'll fly you down here. You know, she's living in Austin at the time. And so that was the 13th. On the 15th, I flew out to Austin, you know, so like, I mean, hastily packed up some of the stuff in my house, left everything, just left without saying anything to anybody whatsoever. You know, said my goodbyes to Stephanie, my girlfriend at the time. And, you know, I was going to Austin. I didn't even realize, like, I was so far gone at this point, you know, that I wasn't even aware that it was my birthday. You know, the 15th of February is the day I left. And I had no idea whatsoever until, like, and I don't really, I was told this, like, the night before, I was staying at a friend's house who was going to take me to the airport in the morning. And I called my drug dealer, and she came and brought me, you know, gave me an extra gram. And I was like, what's this for? Thinking like she somehow knew I was going to rehab. And she's like, well, it's your birthday, sweetheart. It's like, I'd known her for several years now. And that's when I was like, oh my God, like, my own drug dealer remembered my birthday, and I don't even remember it at all. And like, here I am, like, getting dope in the middle of the night before I get on an airplane. Like, what the fuck's wrong with me? You know? And so, I mean, I was so out of it. Like, I brought like 6 grams of heroin on the plane with me, just like in my pocket, thinking like, if I went through security, I would just tell them that I'm going, like, the reason I'm here is to go to rehab. And they'd be like, oh, well, right this way, sir. You know, like, shit like that. It was so no logic at all. Like, and then nothing happened either. You know, I was doing it in the plane. And I mean, I missed like my first flight because I must have passed out like in the airport somewhere. And, you know, I had to fly to like Phoenix and then Las Vegas and then to Austin or something like that because I missed my flight. And, you know, I was so incoherent that, like, I remember the first flight was like wheels up. Don't remember anything. Must have ordered a cranberry juice. Wheels down, like, when an AirPod falls out of my tray. And I'm on the aisle seat too, going from Milwaukee to Phoenix, just probably like drool and shit on me, you know, just fucking the people next to me. It was a packed flight. They must've been like, what the fuck is going on here? You know, it was so ridiculous that I even made it without incident. I mean, like, without legal incident, you know. And my mom was like, that was the worst day of my life. Like, we couldn't get a hold of you. I was calling your friends. They couldn't get a hold of you. You were sending like random incoherent text messages and like some picture of the sunset. I don't know. It was a mess, you know? And so I get to Austin, and my mom is waiting there, and like, it's super late at night. We have to like get my bags because they were like transferred over. It was just a mess. But in my mind, I was like, this is going to be good. You know, I'm still high at this point. Obviously I'm going to go to treatment. Everything's going to be A-okay, you know? And obviously, like, this is a Sunday too. And so, no, this was Saturday night. And so I wake up Sunday, you know, I'm starting to withdraw and I'm getting sick. And, she is just Googling places to go to, like, rehab in Austin. She's a normal person. She doesn't know, like, what, you know, to do. And she's, like, calling all these places and getting, like, the cost and just being like, oh, my God, you know. And finding out, like, I couldn't get into treatment unless I went to detox. So, whatever. So, Monday comes, President's Day. Bank is closed. And she was supposed to bring cash to this detox place so I could get in. So I had to wait another day. So by the time I get into detox on my first day of my 7-day detox, I'm like 58 hours into withdrawal. And it's like noon. And it just was coincidental that everyone in that detox, like all dozen people there, were on their last day. So they're all normal. And I'm dragging my ass in with clothes I haven't showered or eaten in 6 days or something stupid like that. Just embarrassing. Like, even in my state, I was like, I know. This is embarrassing, you know? And, it wasn't until like 2.5, 3 more days in detox, if there's some writhing in pain in bed, where, cause I was doing it cold turkey. Like, they offered me like a small dose of Suboxone, and I laughed like, that's not going to do anything. And so that's when I started to kind of see the light, you know? And like, I remember, you know, I remember like during my addiction too, one of the big things I realized that was like bad was music. I was like more detached from music. I wasn't playing music with people anymore. I wasn't getting into bands, you know, and like, I definitely remember not feeling, you know, I love music, but I wasn't getting that feeling inside because you don't have that genuine happiness. And like, that was killing me, you know, knowing that that was one of those things that I was losing with my addiction, even in my addiction, was awful. And so I, even in my head, I was like, I always thought, I've said this before, I was like, I know I can get sober. I'm pretty sure I can get sober with help, but I don't know if I'm broken. You know, I don't know if I've lost my soul. Like, I don't know if I'll be a shell of who I was. And that scared me, you know, like it scared me to be sober and just drag my lifeless, you know, ass through life without any charisma or anything, you know? And like, so like, you know, the first several days of being detox, I was fucking worried about that, you know, like I felt physically ill, I felt mentally exhausted. And I remember, when I got to the ranch, it was a Friday afternoon. So like people were leaving and everyone was doing their own thing. And I was kind of feeling better at that point, you know, and there was for those of you guys, the men there, there's like this weight room that has like this door that shuts automatically and like a thick glass pane window. And I look through the window and I see like a guitar and an amp there. And, you know, I hadn't picked up a guitar in quite a while. And I'm like, cool, it must be in this weight room because it's soundproof, right? You know, and so like I turn this amp on and I just start wailing on the guitar, you know, like thinking no one's around, no one's hearing it. Well, you know, like I was closing my eyes and kind of in my back. So I open my eyes after like 10 minutes. I'm just jerking off on the guitar and like staff and all the clients like were looking in this window at me, like, and you know, I was embarrassing again, you know, but so I found out it's like the least soundproof room imaginable, like reverberated through the entire building, you know, and I'm like, cool, way to announce my presence here, you know, at this place I'm going to spend 30 days in with just these people, you know, great. Like, but it was so cool to open the door and get all this positive reinforcement from people like, oh man, cool, you play guitar. Like, I know this guy who plays guitar. And I remember Ted, one of the counselors there, was one of the guys who was like, hey, we have like these acoustic guitars in this room, you know, like we normally tell people leave them in there, but if you want to take one in your room, like go ahead. And so I walk in there and then I see like the rec room and there's a ping pong table. And that happens to be like one of the other favorite things I used to love to do. And it was one of those little serendipitous moments where I'm like, I'm in the right place. Like I can do this. Like I am starting to get back online. And like, you know, I felt good about things. Like I wanted help. Like I said, like I wanted to be there. I really did. And now that I was starting to feel physically better, like I was excited, honestly. Like I wanted to do all the programming they talked about, you know, all the class, all that stuff. And, you know, introduce myself. Like I feel super lucky. The group of guys I was in with, I personally got along with like pretty much everybody. The staff there was amazing. Like it was just a very positive experience for me. However, and I tell this to people starting out and people like the kid I'm sponsoring, especially like you have to want it. There has to be some wanting it or just like faking it, you know, till you make it, I guess, like they say. So like I was happy to dive in headfirst. That was the start of a very positive 30 days for me. And I met amazing people like Daniel, you know, and people that I'm still in contact with today. And like this was my only go around in any sort of treatment, but from talking to people who have long sobriety, who have been in multiple treatment centers, if anyone here has been to AR, you know, pretty much, you know, it's alumni, like we're lucky. We have, even just to have like this alumni group is an incredibly lucky thing. You know, I mean, I think one of the big things that helps people after they get out of treatment is, you know, staying staying involved, staying active in recovery, and having stuff like this helped me. And, you know, like I said, when I got out, it was March. So, the whole COVID thing happened, and like, I was bummed. I was not going to be able to go to some place and physically sit down with people and have an IOP. And, you know, I know a lot of people had gripes, you know, and have gripes about Zoom meetings. And I was too. I was like, this sucks. You know, I'm going to be doing this 4 days a week, like 3 hours every night. And so, but eventually my attitude about it changed. Cause I guess like, what if this pandemic happened in 1992? Would we be faxing each other? You know, nothing would have happened. Like, we wouldn't have had it. So I was kind of like, it could be so much worse. You know, we could have none of this. And so, I was really, from what I'd learned about like doing my review, you know, when I started doing that and like writing it down, like I still do that. Like, that was one of the most important things for me, is like, when you get annoyed about something or with someone, no matter how big or small, like taking those steps seems like such an obvious thing, but a lot of people don't do it. So like, hey, why am I angry? Like, should I be angry? You know, should I be annoyed? Is this person the source of that? Or is this me? Or is it something else that I'm taking it on this person? All that, you know, and I remember Chris explaining it really well. Like, by the time you're done with that, you almost forget about what pissed you off in the first place. And so at first, like, that kind of pissed me off. I'm like, well, I knew I should be angry about something, and like, I need to like take it out on somebody, you know, but I did what I was told and I don't feel angry anymore. And well, shit, it works, you know, like that type of thing. And so, another thing that, I had found out too about myself is that like, I kind of, you know, thrived with structure, you know, having like, wake up, you know, at 6 o'clock and then go to eat breakfast and then, you know, meditate. Like, that was a huge thing for me. And then going to class, like, stuff that like I normally, you know, I hadn't done since like high school, and always thought like, I don't like that, you know, but I definitely did. And I try and like keep some sort of structure outside, after getting out. And another really, really cool thing that happened when I was there personally was, we had like a talent show where people got up and just did, you know, sang karaoke, played whatever. And we all did some stuff. Chris played. And I remember Chris saying, you know, cause like, I feel like I've played guitar in bands, but like playing and singing and like, in front of people, it makes me nervous. And like, I really always wanted to write my own music and put it out there for people. And after the talent show, he said, you know, the point of this wasn't to like have a talent show. It was to do something that makes you uncomfortable, that's healthy, because that's how you grow, you know? That really resonated with me. And I still think about that pretty much every day. How about, you know, going through about my life, you know? And I want to go to school now and get a degree. And it's like I said before, I would always dread taking those first steps, and I still do, but it's like the make your bed analogy, you know, just start it. Or I heard this in a meeting a while ago, like, you know, like an old lawnmower, you know, I'm hard to get started, but once I get going, you know, I'll go, I'll just do it. I'll go all out. You know, it's like all or nothing for me. And so, for me, it wasn't like trauma or bad things that happened to me that made me an addict or got me like deep into addiction. Life was good. You know, I was complacent. You know, I actually got bored with my life being good too. And, you know, having like a lot of money, like at least for me at the time, you know, not only made me like, you know, really irresponsible, but I almost felt like kind of invincible. Cause, oh yeah, like I said, growing in Colorado, growing weed's legal, you know, and I was good at that. I was always good at that. I forgot that part of the story. So I was like growing a lot of weed, and like, that's legal, but taking it back to Wisconsin and selling it for a lot more, that is not legal. And so like, honestly, once, you know, you start doing dope and you're, you're clutching the steering wheel, driving 15 hours back to Wisconsin, trying to like act normal, like, you know, having that chemical, opiate in my body made things be like, yeah, whatever, I'll get out of it. Just like my whole mentality about getting on the plane, going to rehab, thinking like, I'll talk my way out of it. Like I do with everything else, you know? So, yeah, the point of that is that, you know, everyone's recovery looks different because everyone's addiction is different. And like, you know, I met a lot of people that, had awful childhood trauma, you know, that was part of like their addiction story and like just trauma in any part of their life. And that wasn't really the case for me. But that was explained to me by counselors and people that that doesn't change how bad an addiction might be, or it doesn't like justify theirs and make you feel like, you know, don't feel like a pussy, you know, like I carried a lot of guilt. My biggest thing was, and still is, I kind of wrecked someone's life. Like my girlfriend at the time, like she, good girl. And I introduced her to this awful drug and like, I really ruined her life, you know? And she doesn't like hold any resentment. She said, I'm a big girl. I make my own decisions. And that almost makes it harder for me. It almost makes it harder. Like I almost want her to be like, yeah, fuck you. You know, like you are an awful human being. Like, how could you do this? Because to me, that's like what I feel like I deserve, you know? And when I made my amends, there are so many supportive people. And I really didn't get that, like, no, I don't forgive you, you know, go to hell type of thing. And I almost wanted that. You know, it was funny, like a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, after doing taxes for the first time in 7 years, I got a letter back from the IRS saying, like, yeah, we're, you know, I was wondering where my tax return was, because I still, like, I did, like, the past 3 years. I'm not going to do all seven. I'm not, like, that good of a person. I'm just, like, sober now, you know. So they were, like, they sent me a letter saying, like, yeah, we took your tax returns. You owe us, like, $5,000 or something like that from 2013. And I kind of was, like, bummer, but sweet. You know, I needed to have some sort of punishment. Like, I felt like I was getting away with too many things here, you know. Like, I just skated through this decade-long addiction. And, like, you know, I remember, like, and detox too, taking my blood test and pumping that tennis ball for what seemed like hours, you know, and I'm still like in withdrawals. It's my first day and it just happened to be blood test day. And all that came back totally fine. Like, yeah, you're healthy. I'm like, what? Really? You know, like, really? Okay, great. Like, I'll just go about my life, I guess. So it was like, you want to feel, or at least I wanted to feel some sort of punishment, you know, and I know I'm extremely lucky. I'm lucky. Just for luck's sake, I'm lucky to have like a mother that I could just call and say, hey, I'm fucking up. Please help me. And it happening. You know, I'm lucky that I met all of you great people. And like, I'm lucky to have this right now. Like, just right now, I'm talking and rambling on about my life story. And you're all listening. Well, maybe you aren't. I don't know. I don't blame you. But like, it's just incredible to me that there's this type of life after all this, I guess. You know, it sounds cheesy. And like, there were so many cheesy things that I'd heard about, like, you know, recovery and stuff like that. And like, you know, it works if you work and stuff like that, but like, it's true. Like all this stuff is true. It's repeated over and over because a lot of it, there's a lot of truth to it, you know? And like, the 12 steps, I've said this before, I knew nothing about the 12 steps. I knew you know, it had something to do with God, and I was not down with that, which was, again, made super clear to me by Chris and by people there that it doesn't have to be like Jesus Christ. And that was like, oh, okay, well then fine, sure, like I'll figure this out then, you know, like I could have gone to a place that really pushes that whole God thing on you and the Jesus thing, and like it would have been a totally different outcome, you know, that, and like, you know, making amends, that Seinfeld episode, like I've said that before, that's all I knew about the 12 steps. And so I was, you know, went in raw, and just didn't know what to expect. But you know, the point is, I guess I'll wrap it up here, being open to things in life now and in recovery, and just open to recovery, you know, and help, you know, asking for help, like, anyone who's been in any meeting with me knows that like all this really is boiling down to to gratitude and how much gratitude I have for everyone and everything that I've gone through. And part of me thinks too, like, hey, I needed to go through all of that to be a better person, you know, and to, like I've said before, the 12 steps are great for addicts, but it's pretty much like just a good way to live your life. In fact, I feel like everyone, normal people, non-addicts, whatever, we should all be able to go to a place for 30 days and just figure out our shit. You know, that would be great. Like, life would be a better place if we were able to work our shit out like that. And so, but I'll wrap it up saying, like, what really clicked for me is when we were in the van, you know, and I was able to go to an offsite meeting. Aaron was driving the van. And he put on some stupid pop song, you know, some song that I would never care about or anything, but like it was music, you know, and I remember crying, you know, I remember feeling that emotion again. I remember feeling that amazing, overwhelming feeling of music wash over me. And that was one of those moments where I was like, this is working. And I'm not going to just be sober and a shell of myself. I'm going to be who I was again. And so, you know, that whole, like, starting my life feeling that way about music and like losing that and then feeling that in the van, you know, it just kind of came full circle. And I just felt so incredibly grateful and happy in that moment. You know, it was one of those things where, I think it was someone there in the van, like, you okay? Like, you know, yeah, I just got something in my eye, you know, like, you know, it was one of those type of things. But deep down, I wanted to be like, yes, like, you have no idea, like, how amazing, like, this is to me, you know, like, so yeah, I'm done here. I just wanted to say how grateful I am, not just to be in recovery and to learn all of the, you know, things I have from Austin Recovery. But I want to thank Chris for everything, not just at the ranch and what he does there, but to facilitate these type of meetings and keep this community of people, even in the recovery, you know, of all the places to go, I, you know, don't know about them, but this has to be one of the best and one of the best run, you know, as far as like ground level people, like, my mom just picked it out of Google, you know, and I happened to come to Austin because she lived here. That's it. You know, I would have no other reason to be here. So again, gratitude is huge in my life. And I love all you guys. Thanks for letting me tell my story. I actually had notes that I never looked at. So the timeline probably jumped all over the place. But you guys know me right now. This is just how, like, I say stuff. So thanks again for putting up with this.
Thank you, Nicholas, for sharing. That's awesome. For listening, hi, guys.
Great job, Nicholas.
Well done, buddy.
Awesome job, Nicholas.
Thanks, guys.
Hi, I love you.